You're listening to Community Radio, KGNU Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins, and it is time for our monthly radio book club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian, the head buyer of the Boulder Bookstore, and we're bringing it right back to Boulder this time with a very local author who has really exploded with his first book, The Long Haul. Tell us about Finn Murphy's book, The Long Haul, and why you've selected it, Arsene, for the book club.
Well, you know, I've bought a lot of books over the year, and I don't ever recall a book like this, where, a trucker, a mover, really gives us the inside scoop. And I thought it was just a fascinating book. And you couple that with the fact that Finn lives about a block from me. I thought, why not bring him in on a snowy day into the book club? And it's just such an interesting look when we get into the sociology and what it takes to drive a big truck. And you know, it's not the type of book I would normally read, but there's so many great stories in this book, and I thought it would be great fodder to discuss.
Well, Finn Murphy, you actually were on KGNU about a year ago, I think, when the book first came out. We're delighted to have you back in. And as I said, this book has exploded. It has captured people's imagination. And I think it's because, first of all, you're a wonderful storyteller. But as Arsene said, it hits on so many topics, sociological issues, economic issues, a change in what's happening in society, and of course just, you know, a whole bunch of stories about life on the road. So it's good to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, Maeve. Thanks, Arsene.
So, you know, you weren't really destined to be a truck driver. Your background was you grew up in Connecticut, and this was, you were going to be college bound, and you don't have the typical demographic of what you would have thought at that point in time a trucker would have, probably even less so now. We can get into that later. And I was struck by this passage very early in the book. Hard work temporarily shut down the constant movie running in my brain that looped around in an endless cacophony of other people's expectations, obligations, guilt, anger, and rebellion. So what really drove you into this career from what would have been the expectations and the obligations that you were facing as a teenager?
Well, thanks for bringing that particular sentence up. It's actually a pretty good sentence. It rolled right off the page there. I think what had happened, it was a reaction against regimentation, I think, is what it was. I come from this very large Irish Catholic family. I've got 7 brothers and sisters. I've got an 89-year-old mother who's a sort of a typical Irish matriarch. And then I went to 12 years of parochial school. And all of our social activities were all around the church. So I was regimented at home, I was regimented at school, and I was regimented in my leisure hours, such as they were. So when I started working for this moving company, I started taking these short little road trips with the truck with other drivers. And the freedom of that seduced me. And just being away from everybody looking over my shoulder, living under a microscope, that was my initial attraction.
It's interesting that you say it was the freedom and the open road that really attracted you. But what I was fascinated by was the fact that you found this almost zen-like state by the order that you had to impose on the stuff that you were moving. So you're moving people, packing up someone's house, packing it into a truck, moving it across country, and then unpacking. And you describe the almost ritualistic aspect of this, and it seems so ordered in many ways that you have to, you know, what you pack first, how you disassemble things, how you reassemble, how you load the truck. So it was interesting that you were attracted, I suppose, by the sense of freedom and the open road, but then you found a real sense of order within the profession itself.
And I think part of that was also a reaction about chaos, which is growing up in this huge house, not huge house, with this huge family in a small house and under the, you know, very broad thumb of my mother. And as I said, the whole society around me, it was chaotic. So when I got onto a moving truck and saw that everything had a place and everything had an order, and then dealing with machinery and big trucks where everything has an order, and dealing with schedules and punctuality where everything had an order, all of that I found extremely attractive.
You came into, as you started your career, you had a lot of anger. And you describe other truck drivers as having a lot of anger. And it seems like later in your career, as you have a different attitude, you can really see it in other people. But you feel that was pretty typical of the profession, or you think it was, is it a typical male thing going on in this country. I mean, you really can't. It's hard not to see that anger on the page, you know, especially the first half of your career.
Yes, that's true. And so actually the book is sort of divided up into two parts. And the first part is me as a very young man in this occupation. So not only am I a long haul trucker, I'm also a mover. I work for a van line, so I move families. So that's a thread that throughout the book. But the way that I look at the work at the job is very different in parts one and parts two. I'd like to think I'm becoming a better, more compassionate, smarter person as I get older, but it's very clear in the beginning of the book that I'm none of those things at all. And it's honest. It's not particularly complimentary to me in the beginning, but I hope it does show some sort of progression.
Arson said that you were a very unlikely person to take up this career. You were destined really for a white collar world, ended up in a blue collar world. Ultimately, you were estranged from your parents for what, 2 years, when you told them you were dropping out of college to pursue life on the road?
Yes, they erased my name from the family Bible for a short period of time. I grew up in, you know, a suburb right outside of New York City. All seven of my brothers and sisters went to college. We were all supposed to be, you know, in the professions. And part of that, though, was we all had to have summer jobs between college and in our college summers. And it was very much encouraged by our family to take manual labor jobs. One, to make money, and one, maybe to show us what the other side of the labor and economic pool might look like. I'm not sure that they understood that I would be seduced by that. That's an unintended consequence. But yes, I quit college at the end of my junior year because I had taken a trip down to Virginia Beach in the summer before my junior year and went down and went through the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel there on US 13. Got into Virginia Beach. It was just all so new and so exciting that I was watching the money that could be made back then. And the driver that I was with, he was making over $100,000 in 1979. Even though my family was very interested in education and culture, we were not wealthy. And I didn't really have any idea about where I was going to go with the rest of my life with not having any money or anything like that. So I thought this might be a way to put some money away. And it worked out that way.
I mean, we talk about it. It's a blue-collar profession. But at the same time, extraordinary amounts of money were being made by certain truckers. Because you do talk about the different categories of truckers, people who haul livestock, people who haul other things, FedEx drivers and folks like yourself. And you're, I suppose, at the top of that pyramid in terms of how much money can be made. I was really astonished. You said that up to $100,000 or even more through these long haul moving trips.
Yeah, well, these days, so I mean, over 200 for a top tier mover who's doing corporate stuff, which is what I do. So I move executives, movie stars, ambassadors, those kinds of people. So it's actually a lot of fun. It's also an interesting dichotomy because the people I work with are, you know, at the very, very low end of the economic ladder, the crews that help me load and unload. And then the people I'm working for, you know, the people have these 20,000 square foot houses in Aspen, and that's their third home.
What I was fascinated by was the culture within the truckers themselves, because even though the movers are making all the money, and you would think this would be a very prestigious thing, the other truckers don't see it like that. You're kind of at the bottom when you pull into a truck stop, right? I mean, you're not welcomed very heartily by the other truck drivers. And maybe you can talk about a little bit about that and why that is and how you reacted to that.
Yeah, so there's this whole hierarchy. A lot of it has to do with how much driving you do. So if you're of say, we call them freight haulers. So if you're hauling a freight box for a big company like Werner or Swift or Schneider or one of those, you might be going from New Jersey to San Diego every week. And you might do that four times a month. So you're doing 12,000 miles a month. That's 240,000 miles a year. Those guys consider themselves at the very, very apex because they're the ones laying down the miles. Now, the movers that work for van lines, we spend a lot of our time loading and unloading trucks. We spend a lot of our time with our customers. So I might do 80,000 miles a year on a busy year. So we're looked down upon for that. And we're looked down upon because of our income. And we're looked down upon because we actually do the manual labor of loading and unloading our trucks. And we're not really motorheads, most movers. So we're different. So we don't, like when you sit down at the coffee counter, the first thing another trucker is going to ask you is, what you driving? And half the time, I mean, I don't know what I'm driving.
Truck.
It's a big truck. You know, they want to know the wheelbase. They want to know, you know, how big the engine is and what the torque is and all these kinds of stuff. I mean, I'm a mover. I work for families. I'm not really part of that world.
We're speaking with Finn Murphy this morning on our Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. His first book is The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. And Finn was a trucker. He was a long haul. He was a mover, so he would move families, high-end moves, ambassadors, corporate executives. And he's our guest this morning on the Radio Book Club. My co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian.
Well, one of the parts of the book I loved is all you're describing some of the different people that you moved in great detail. You have maybe a half dozen of these kind of, or maybe even a few more than that. One of my favorite people was when you showed up at an older woman's house and she had hoarded all sorts of stuff. And you're just trying to figure out what of her stuff to get on the truck. And, you know, how common is that? And maybe you can tell that specific story a little bit about what it was like to try to figure out what in the world you're moving out of this house.
Hoarders are certainly a different breed. I think there's a TV show about hoarders, I'm pretty sure. It's really funny, or it's been fascinating for me doing this for decades, is to watch people's relationship with the stuff that they have. I learned just so much from that, and I try not to bring a whole lot of judgment about it, but because I get to live in the continuum of the way people acquire things and then the way that they get rid of things through the course of a lifetime, because I've done, I don't know, 3,200 moves or something like that. And sometimes I move very young people and they're in the, you know, they're picking things up, and then middle-aged people sort of collecting. And then as you get older, you start getting rid of things. And then when you die, then everything gets gotten rid of. So I just love to watch how that changes depending on your life circumstances and depending on your age. People always ask me, what's the best advice I could give them when they're moving? And the advice I always give is the one that nobody takes, which is just get rid of everything you've got and pack yourself a suitcase. But people don't do that. They get very attached to their things. And what I see and what the person I'm moving doesn't necessarily see is that the kids' drawings on the refrigerator door or the high school yearbook or Aunt Tilly's antique vanity, all of these things are going to get thrown away at the end. When somebody's tired of paying the storage fees, or you've passed on and the house is full of stuff, all that is going away into the dumpster.
In terms of the stuff that we keep, one of the things that just jumped out at me in a way that made me so sad was that you said people aren't reading anymore because you're moving so much fewer books. Families don't have books in their homes anymore.
They don't have books. The way that houses have changed, I read a statistic somewhere that houses are 35% bigger than they were in 1980. Houses are much larger. You have kitchen islands now, which go into the family room or the den. Instead of, a painting over the fireplace, you've got a 72-inch flat screen. The books are gone. Again, I try not to bring judgment to this, but I have noticed it. It's you can't not notice it. In the same way that you can't not notice how small towns have been denuded in their core districts and all the new development is all on the outskirts. These things, in my opinion, have a social cost and a cultural cost that I don't think that we calculate.
Well, that's one of the things that really struck me as well, is just your observations of how America has changed so much. It really struck me that I don't ever want to go to Florida after reading this book because of the unabated sprawl that seems to have happened. But you compare that with what's happened here in Colorado as well, and the sprawl that we've had with the single family homes that have just spread further and further up into the mountains. I mean, you, as somebody who crisscrosses the country so many different times over so many years, I'm sure have just seen so many changes in that regard.
Yes, and I don't think the change has registered. I don't think it usually registers. I've been in a weird seat for all of these years because I've been through, America's got about 15,000 towns. I've probably been in or through most of them. And this pattern of hollowing out of a traditional core district and then the development taking place on the outside with big boxes, that's done everywhere. People tend to think, oh, well, it just happened in my town or it happened in the town next door. It's happened throughout the entire country. So the especially, you know, in the middle of the country, the whole country's been hollowed out. And I think you have to be on the road for decades and go through all these places in order to notice that. I'm sure that the big boxes have noticed it.
Your economic driver that you identify, though, is of the towns that are still vibrant, which aren't too many, is a university. It's not a big factory. It's not a big, you know, tech thing or something. In the book, you mentioned that the universities seem to be the last kind of engines that can support a traditional town in a way.
Yes, and you don't have to be. I mean, I'm certainly no cultural anthropologist, so more sort of an opinionated truck driver. but you can see this if you drive through Mississippi. You go through one dying town after another, and then you get into Oxford, which is where the University of Mississippi is, and all of a sudden you have all of this prosperity. Same thing in so many other places. Ann Arbor, Michigan's another one. You go through all of these dying towns, and then you end up in Ann Arbor. Or if you want to use Colorado as an example, you know, you want to talk about sprawl, you know, the Front Range is every bit as sprawly as Phoenix or Fort Lauderdale. And then you have this little Boulder bubble that they call it. Because the people have taken control or tried to take control over what their town or city is going to look like. And that's what I think happens is people are taking their kids to ballet practice or soccer practice, and they're working in their lives, and they don't have time to work in their, you know, in their local governments or their municipalities. And so all of this sprawl happens around them, and they're not in control of it. But in college towns, they are in control of it.
Yeah, one of the other observations you make is around military towns, because you do a lot of military moves as well. But you talk about, and it was really sad that you can often tell you're coming into a military base area. There's so many pawn stores. There are so many used car lots and just everything that seems to indicate we have failed financially here. And that seems to surround so many of these military bases.
Yes, I think it's very difficult for military families. They don't make nearly as much money as you know, an average middle-class American. They have more children than average middle-class Americans. You know, this is just a general statement. It's not true for everybody. But you do find the support, the economic support system for people in economic difficulty. And as I think I said in the book, you don't have to be an economist to understand when you see a whole bunch of pawn shops that there's something going wrong.
At one point, you talk about you quit the truck driving business for several years, 8 years maybe, I can't remember exactly. And part of that is you're down in Florida, and you were supposed to do a military move, and it doesn't pan out. Maybe you talk about why did you leave, and then maybe we can get into what was different about you and the business maybe when you came back.
Yes, so that was when I left North American Van Lines. I was working for them at the time. I was supposed to move the Admiral from the Naval Air Station at Key West. And I used to love going to Key West. There's a great story in my book, actually, during Fantasy Festival, I got lost and I'm driving down Duval Street in Key West, which is the main drag. And I was driving very tentatively. And this group of men that were sitting at a street side bar looked at me and they said, "Do you know where you're going?" And I said, "No." And they all jumped onto my fuel tanks and started hooting and hollering, taking me down Duval Street to the end. That was a lot of fun. But I was supposed to move the CO. And these trucking companies are all, you know, let's just say they need to cover their freight and they don't much care who's doing it. And I had been doing this for 11 years at the time and I was getting burnt out. And a different van line had come in and taken that particular shipment. So I just had it and then I quit. And that was sort of the end of my first phase of my trucking career. And it was kind of the end of letting anger and frustration sort of rule me and the first steps toward becoming a smarter person.
When you come back with a different attitude. And I was wondering if you could read a passage about when you decide to get back into the business several years later.
In 2008, I found myself washed ashore in a city out west where I knew nobody. I was 51 years old, single, with no job, no plans, no nothing. I was unmoored. It was the most difficult period of my life. I don't want to think about how I'd lit the fuse to my previous life and watched it explode. All I wanted to do was go back on the road. I wanted to climb into a truck, hit that start button, watch the air pressure build up, and go. In that respect, I knew I'd have plenty of company among other drivers. That's what we do. 51 years old is not a propitious age to go back to building tiers in a moving van. I was in decent shape, but moving furniture is young man's work. I wasn't at all sure I could make the grade. What I did know was that I could certainly perform other tasks much better than before. I was no longer a young man in a hurry. I wasn't a young man at all. I was another piece of flotsam hitting the road because I thought I'd run out of options. Another thing I knew now was that moving, for the customer, was to experience an emotional nosedive. Maybe I couldn't lift like I used to, but maybe, just maybe, I could use my own failures and hard-earned understanding to grease the wheels of my work and make the experience easier for the people who were moving. Maybe I could breach the wall of suspicion and enmity people have about movers. That felt attractive. I wanted to do it the right way, the way I had never done it before. I wanted to interact with my customers and helpers applying compassion and professionalism. I wanted to approach the work itself with serious intellectual intention toward performing even the smallest tasks properly.
And that's the real fulcrum of your journey, the book. I mean, the stories that come after that are much different stories. It's really you looking at the psychological element and helping people. You have one great story about the family's prized possession is a baby grand piano. And things don't work out well there, and how you handle that and how they handle that and trying to get families through these really difficult times. Do you find more satisfaction through this period later in your career in being able to do this in a way?
Definitely more satisfying. And there's actually two different levels to that. One of them is working with the families and trying to navigate their transition from one new home to from one home to another home. I really like that. And moving is so fraught with emotional baggage. I mean, it's hard for the children. It's hard for the families, the husband and wife. Somebody's status as an earner is threatened. Extended families are separated. This is very hard things for people to do. And when, from my first phase as a mover, I didn't care about any of that. I didn't care about any of those people. I was just trying to make some money. And now it's totally different. So it's much more enjoyable, for one. I do a better job, for two. And the second part of this is how much I enjoy working and doing the actual physical work, which is hard. But if you've done physical work for any length of time that's manual and repetitive, like emptying somebody's house for 12 hours, there is a zone in there that's sort of zen-like. And then the third part of this is working with the men that I work with. It's almost all men. There's a few women in the movie business, but it's all men. And there's something tribal about a hard physical task that a group of men are banding together to get done. There's something elemental about it. I think that's how we've all worked together for the last few hundred thousand years. And I think we miss that a lot in our workplaces.
That's Finn Murphy talking about his experience as a mover and then a long haul trucker, which he writes about in his first book, The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. Joining us on KGNU as our guest on our monthly radio book club. Finn, do you think it's possible for somebody like yourself now in this day and age in 2018 to get into the long haul moving business and make the kind of money that you did? Because you also talk a lot about the changing demographics of truck drivers in general, but also with movers because of deregulation and then kind of union busting, I suppose, a little bit. But, you know, what is the current situation now for drivers and truckers?
Well, there are very few people that specialize. I mean, there's a lot of movers out there. There are very few people that just do sort of high-end relocation. So the air is very thin up there in that income bracket. And you have to be with a company for a long time and you have to have a lot of experience. And most people who enter the trucking industry enter it from a trucking school and then they go to one of the big freight hauling companies. And the average wage for an American truck driver is between $36,000 and $40,000 a year. So this is what somebody once called a poverty profession. And it used to be a middle class profession. Back in the 70s, 60s, and 70s, it was middle class. There were independent truck drivers who owned their own trucks. They did fairly well. There were unionized truck drivers. They did very well. Now that's basically all disappeared.
We're going to see that getting hollowed out even further, I suppose, now with automation and the loss of even those very bare minimum paid jobs.
Yes. So the trend here is to eliminate human drivers completely out of the supply chain. I think that everybody's talking about autonomous vehicles. And what you read about has to do with cars and how complicated it is and how it's, you know, it's never going to happen. But you've got Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, General Motors, Ford, Tesla, Volvo, Toyota. You have some of the largest, most well-capitalized companies in the world are in a space race for the first autonomous vehicle. And when I say autonomous vehicle, I mean trucks, because that's where the money's going to be. Getting rid of truck drivers. There's 3.5 million truck drivers in the U.S. And the only humans left in that supply chain, if you go to a modern warehouse now, it's all machines doing everything. So the only humans left are the drivers. And frankly, look at it from the other side. Most vehicle accidents are caused by human error.
Okay, maybe the driving across the country could be replaced by an automated vehicle. But a lot of what you do is going into the house and individually packing all these items and dragging them down the stairs or over the driveway or this or that. And that seems hard to automate. The real meat of your job seemed to be being in these people's houses and packing the stuff up and trying to figure that aspect of it out.
Yes, and not losing their people's things and not destroying them, not getting them stolen. Those are all definitely parts of the job. And that, yes, emptying a house of furniture, you know, over, you know, a course of a 12-hour day, that's not going to be replaced anytime soon until the, you know, the Star Trek matter energy transporter, until that comes, we'll be doing that. We'll be dragging the things across the driveway.
Well, in terms of the dynamics then of families that you encounter at a specific time, because when you're moving, it's a major life disruption. And it's very often due to a divorce, debt, you know, it's some type of displacement. So I'm sure you just become a keen observer of dynamics between spouses, between families. And then even if the family is staying together with the move, it often seems that there's one person is causing the move. It's one person's job that is causing the family to uproot and move across. I mean, is there a commonality that you've seen when you're meeting families at this time?
Yes, there always seems to be some level of conflict. And a lot of it has to do with a husband and wife, or a husband who's no longer with a wife, or a death. All of those things, I see those all the time. And what, if you want a commonality, is rather than think about a person's place in the community, or what a person's family life is going to look like now, or what your friends you're going to have, or the friends that you're losing, or any of those things, people tend to zero back in on their stuff. And it becomes about the crock pot instead of, my sister who lives four doors down. And I think it's a way not to think about those kinds of things. So what happens is, you put a crack in the mover puts the crack in the crock pot. And then all of a sudden there's a nuclear conflagration about the crock pot. And it's not about the crock pot. And I know that because I've seen this 3,200 times, but she's only moved twice. So she doesn't understand that when she's screaming at me about her crock pot, that it's not about that. So I'm cool with that. I can take that all day long, no problem. And I'm not going to say, ma'am, this is not about the crock pot. I'm not a psychotherapist. But that's really what it is.
I guess you could be a psychotherapist if you're looking for yet another career.
Well, some people call me a cultural anthropologist, and some people call me an opinionated wise guy. So I hope to be somewhere in between those two things.
Well, the book is chock full of anecdotes and observations on society, from everything that we've talked about, from urban sprawl to the economy to the relationship to all of the junk that we tend to populate our lives with. And it's all in The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road, the first book by Finn Murphy, who has been our guest at the Radio Book Club. There are so many other stories to tell. We're going to invite people to check out the podcast After Hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a podcast only edition. Finn will stay with us and share some more anecdotes. You can check that out on iTunes. But in the meantime, for our next installment of the Radio Book Club, it's a slightly different thing. It's about horses. David Phillips digs into wild horses in his book, Wild Horse Country.
Yeah, this is a wonderful book. And he really traces the origin of the wild horse in America from the Pueblo Revolt till now, and how they're handled through the dog food days to the protected status now. It comes up in the news all the time. There was just an issue a few months ago about what the BLM was going to do and if they're going to try to make some changes to the wild horse law. So it's a really fascinating book, and we have wild horses. There are some in Colorado.
David Phillips will be at the Boulder Bookstore on March 1st. But he will be our guest on the Radio Book Club March 22nd at 9 a.m. And the book is Wild Horse Country. In the meantime, I'd like to thank the guest for this installment of the Radio Book Club. Finn Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran with my co-host, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore.